From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we ask Zev Chaffetz what he thinks of his country's decision to attend the Middle East Peace Conference. Chaffetz formerly directed the Israeli government press office and now edits the magazine The Jerusalem Report. He'll also tell us why he decided to leave his home in Michigan to become an Israeli citizen, even though Israel didn't have much to offer in the way of rock and roll. Also, a talk with composer and director Elizabeth Suedos about her new family memoir. She grew up in the 50s and 60s in an upper-middle-class family. Family problems were not to be discussed in public. Nothing prepared the family for the mental illness that eventually destroyed it. And book critic John Leonard reviews two new mysteries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There are conflicting reports from the Middle East on whether American hostage Jesse Turner has been released by his Lebanese captors. Security sources in Beirut said earlier today that Turner would soon be on his way to U.S. authorities in Damascus. But, as Mike Theodulo reports, Turner's exact whereabouts are unknown.
A senior Syrian official told hordes of reporters waiting for Jesse Turner at the foreign ministry in Damascus to go home and get some sleep. Come back for tea tomorrow, he said. I hope the hostage will soon be released. There are reports that Turner has in fact been freed in Beirut and is now safe in U.S. hands. His trip to Damascus held up by logistical problems. There were reports of heavy fighting between rival Shiite Muslim clans in eastern Lebanon, where the hostages are believed to be held. The eastern Bekaa Valley also cuts the road from Beirut to Damascus. 10 people are reported dead in the clashes, which ended only after the intervention of Syrian army mediators. Earlier today, another kidnapped group said the whole release process could be damaged by Israeli air raids on Hezbollah bases in southern Lebanon this morning. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulo in Nicosia.
The leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat, is in Cairo as part of his tour to coordinate Arab positions ahead of next week's Middle East Peace Conference. Arafat held talks with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak this morning. Afterward, Arafat gave his view of Palestinian representation at the conference. The BBC's Barnaby Mason sent this report from Cairo.
14 Palestinians from the occupied territories have been chosen to negotiate with Israel, a basic team of 7 and 7 substitutes or reserves. Mr. Arafat confirmed that the chief negotiator will be Mr. Haider Abdel Shafi, the head of the Red Crescent in the Gaza Strip. But in response to a question, he said that the head of the whole Palestinian team going to Madrid would be Mr. Faisal Husseini, adding, "And I appointed him." Faisal Husseini has been the man most closely involved in the long negotiations with the American Secretary of State, Mr. Baker. But more important, he comes from East Jerusalem, and as such was excluded from the negotiating team at the demand of the Israelis, who say the status of Jerusalem is not up for discussion. For Mr. Arafat to say that Faisal Husseini was appointed by the chief of the PLO will not go down well in Israel.
The BBC's Barnaby Mason in Cairo. The Bush administration is considering a tax cut for middle-income Americans as part of a package of measures to stimulate the economy. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater told reporters today that the discussion is in the preliminary stages, but that a middle-income tax cut was one of the options. On Sunday, Senate Finance Committee Chairman Lloyd Benson proposed a tax cut of $72.5 billion aimed mostly at the middle-income Americans. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials closed at 3,060. This is NPR. Top staffers at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will recommend that the nation's oldest commercial nuclear plant remain shut down because of safety concerns. In a memorandum to the commission, NRC's operations director said the managers of Yankee Row have been unable to show that the plant could be restarted without an extensive safety test. The NRC staff recommended that the Western Massachusetts plant be shut down because of concerns about the strength of its reactor containment vessel. The governor of California has asked the White House to declare parts of the San Francisco Bay Area a disaster area. The move follows a huge fire that's destroyed more than 400 homes. From San Francisco, NPR's Elaine Corey reports.
The first damage estimate for the East Bay fire is $1.5 billion. Fire officials say they contained the blaze by this morning, although pockets continue to burn within the perimeter. Governor Pete Wilson surveyed the fire zone by helicopter for the second time this morning. He said the fire left terrible devastation.
What showed up last night as burning hot spots in that black of night this morning were clearly the charred ruins of hundreds of homes.
Governor Wilson is hoping a presidential declaration will begin to speed federal disaster relief to the Bay Area within days. State Farm Insurance, California's largest home insurer, says most households will recover 100% of their losses. In San Francisco, I'm Elaine Corey.
Winds picked up across the inland regions of the Pacific Northwest today, threatening to revive wildfires in four states. Authorities had hoped that the fires were contained after burning 275,000 acres last week. In Spokane, Washington, officials prepared for the possibility that they might have to evacuate as many as 200,000 people if the fires were whipped up again. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If Zionist Theodore Herzl and singer Janis Joplin had a child together, it would have been Zev Chafetz. That's how Thomas Friedman described my guest, Zev Chafetz, in the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. Chafetz is an Israeli who grew up in Pontiac, Michigan. He was the director of the Israeli government press office under Prime Minister Menachem Begin. He's also known in Israel for having the first Hebrew doo-wop hit. Chafetz now writes a lively and opinionated political column in the new magazine The Jerusalem Report, which he also edits. His book Double Vision offered a critical analysis of Western press coverage of the Middle East. His book Heroes and Hustlers, Hard Hats and Holy Men was about the new generation of Israelis. Now he's completed his first novel, Inherit the Mob. It's about a Pulitzer Prize-winning American reporter whose late uncle was one of the last old-time Jewish gangsters. We'll talk about the novel a little later. First, let's get a sense of what Chafetz thinks of his country's decision to attend the Middle East Peace Conference.
I think, like most Israelis, I have mixed emotions about it. It's something that we've wanted for a long time. And like many things that you've wanted for a long time, when you get it, you become suspicious of it. But on the whole, I'm glad that we're going, and I'm mildly optimistic that something will come out of it.
You said you wanted it for a long time. I guess that means wanted to sit around the table with representatives of the Palestinians and the Arab countries. Did you want it under the circumstances that you're getting it?
Well, you know, we were spoiled in a way by Anwar Sadat of Egypt, whose peace initiative was so warm-hearted and so demonstrative and so evidently heartfelt that it became the model for how we envisioned other Arab leaders coming forward. And what we're seeing now, both on the Israeli side and especially on the Arab side, is a sort of grudging march to the table under American pressure. And it's not really what we sort of thought of when we were looking at the Sadat model.
Well, do you think it's possible to have anything come out of talks where all the parties seem to be coming kind of reluctantly under pressure?
Well, it appears that all of us have the same motivation in one way. That is, none of us wants to be blamed for being the recalcitrant party. And that's really been the primary motivator for getting people to the table. On the Israeli side, since Israel is the only one of the negotiating countries which is a democracy, the impact of domestic public opinion is going to be crucial regarding whether Israel stays in the talks or not. And that means that the Arab partners on the other side are going to have to convince a large segment of the Israeli public, those in the middle and those on the moderate right, that it's worth staying and it's worth talking. If they don't do that, then I think the government will be under a lot of pressure to break off the talks when the going gets rough.
Well, what are the circumstances under which you think Israel might walk?
Well, if Israel comes to the conference and finds that it's really nothing more than an international forum or kind of a kangaroo court to force it to make unilateral territorial concessions, then I think that it would be under a lot of pressure to get up and leave the conference. The Americans sold this conference on the basis that it was the beginning of a true reconciliation between Israel and the Arab world. And one of the elements in that were the regional talks, in other words, the talks between Israel and all of the Arab countries on water rights and on disarmament and other things, economic cooperation and those things which would signal an acceptance of Israel in the area. If that doesn't happen, and pretty soon, I think that it would be very hard for an Israeli delegation to remain in the talks.
Do you support land for peace, and would you support a two-state solution?
Well, I support some land for real peace. I think that it would be extraordinarily dangerous for us to give up the Golan Heights unless we had the most ironclad kinds of assurances, both about demilitarization and also about Syria's future intentions and the shape of any future Syrian administration. The Gaza Strip, as far as I'm concerned, and I think most Israelis, can go to anybody who wants it. The West Bank, which is probably the most complex of those issues, is not, I don't think, going to be able to be given up at this stage. There are 160,000 Israelis living there. But creative diplomacy could probably find some way to satisfy the Arab territorial demands without requesting that these Israeli cities be uprooted.
So do you think that there should be a Palestinian state?
No, on that I'm in agreement with the government of Israel and the government of the United States. I don't think that there ought to be an independent Palestinian state between Israel and Jordan. I think it would be both too geographically constrained, and also it would be a permanent barrier to normal relations. The Palestinians, after all, have been and remain on the side of the radicals in the Middle East, and it would be very discomforting for us to face an Arafat-led Palestinian state within rifle distance of the Israeli capital.
I don't know if you saw it yesterday, but Tom Friedman in the New York Times had a news analysis piece on the peace talks, and he said that pressing for peace in the Middle East could actually destabilize the area. His points were that the balance of power in the Middle East has evolved. Now, it's not quite peace that you have there. On the other hand, it isn't war, and he points out that the Gulf War wasn't really to establish real peace. It was to restore the balance of power. It even left Saddam Hussein in power when the war was over. Do you agree with him that pressing for, quote, real peace in the Middle East could actually destabilize the area?
Well, that's like saying that the fall of communism could destabilize Eastern Europe. Obviously, any time that there's a change, and in this case, peace would be certainly a positive change, you run the risk of short-term destabilization. The situation that we have and that Tom, who's a good friend, wrote about, I think, correctly yesterday, seems more bearable from the perspective of the New York Times op-ed page than it is from the perspective of Israel. It's fair to say that we aren't really in a state of war, but you would have been hard-pressed to prove that last January, February, when we were being shot at with Scud missiles. And so I'm all in favor of destabilizing the present impasse if what comes in its place is some kind of a more amiable relationship between us and our neighbors.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. You had been the head of the government press office under Menachem Begin from 77 to 82. You were head of the press office.
Right.
Why did you end up leaving?
Well, I came into that job about 6 weeks before Sadat came to Egypt, and so I had the honor and the pleasure of being involved in a very small way in the peace process, and that, of course, was something that I'll probably be very happy to tell my grandchildren about. I left during the war in Lebanon in 1982 in September, and the reason that I left was because I found myself in essential disagreement with the government's policies. And since I had a job which required me to explain and defend Israeli policy, I didn't feel that it would be fair to the government or fair to myself to continue.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Zev Chaifetz. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Zev Chaffetz is my guest. He's an American-born Israeli writer. He directed the Israeli government press office from 77 to 82. He now edits the news magazine The Jerusalem Report, which just completed its first year. And he's also the author of the new novel Inherit the Mob, about the nephew of one of the last of the old-time Jewish gangsters. And we'll talk about this new novel a little later in our talk. You came to Israel from the United States in 1967. I think you were still in college when you went to Israel.
Yes, I was an undergrad at the University of Michigan.
Yeah, why'd you go to Israel? What first attracted you there? And did you didn't plan to stay, right?
I went just for a year, you know, a junior year abroad.
Mm-hmm.
It was the 60s, and everybody was going someplace, and I thought that Israel would be an interesting place to try. I had never been there and hadn't really thought much about it before. And when I got there, I arrived within a couple of weeks of the Israeli victory in the Six-Day War. And the contrast between coming from the campus in Ann Arbor, where anti-Vietnam feeling and really sort of anti-patriotic sentiments were so strong, and also the terrible riot that took place in the city of Detroit just a few days before I left Michigan, to a country like Israel, where everyone was euphoric and very patriotic and very upbeat, was extremely attractive to me. And as I was there for a while, I became attracted by other things, by the historical romance of being in a country which was reborn just about the same time that I was born, and also by some trivial things. I liked the weather. I liked the informality. And so one way or another, I decided to stay on for a while, and in a while became 25 years, and I'm still there.
Was it different for you to learn Hebrew when you got to Israel than it was to learn Hebrew for your bar mitzvah when you were 13?
Well, yeah. I mean, when I learned Hebrew for my bar mitzvah, what I did was, you know, I just memorized the sounds, you know, from a record. And I was able to spout those back, and I promptly forgot every single syllable about 5 minutes after the ceremony. Learning Hebrew when I got to Israel was an act of survival. I mean, I realized that I'd better learn how to speak Hebrew, or I wouldn't be able to function there. And, of course, I was immersed in the country. I spent several years in the Army, and by the time I got out of the Army, I was speaking Hebrew.
Did you become any more or less observant Jew in Israel?
You mean religiously?
Religiously, yeah.
No, I was never a particularly observant Jew in the United States, and I have become probably less so in Israel. Some of my attitudes about religion are colored by the role of religion in Israeli politics, which I find unpleasant and bothersome. And so from time to time I have written in the Jerusalem Report, I write a weekly column there, and I've written some, I think, quite critical things about the Orthodox establishment in Israel, which haven't been appreciated by the Orthodox establishment. I hope they're appreciated by some of the readers of the magazine. And I certainly haven't become more observant. I think of Israel as one big open-air synagogue with lots of rooms in it, including a sanctuary for the people who want to pray, but plenty of other sorts of rooms as well, and I tend to spend most of mine in the social hall or the temple kitchen.
We know you mentioned some of the critical things you've written in your column about the ultra-Orthodox. Let me quote a recent column. You wrote, "The black hats belong to a strange and hostile cult. They teach their own children that we are Gentiles, to be scorned and avoided. They present themselves as the real Jews. They have more in common with Bible-thumping Christian fundamentalists or hysterical Islamic fanatics than to any real Jewishness." Have you gotten a lot of criticism within Israel for that?
No, in Israel, it's funny. You know, in Israel, the discourse is very sharp. We're used to talking to one another at the tops of our lungs. And since the rabbis, the ultra-Orthodox rabbis, have set themselves up as clubhouse politicians, they're fair game for criticism by people like me who don't like that variety of politics. I got a tremendous amount of criticism abroad, in the United States, in England, and other places where the Jerusalem Report is sold, because people in these countries are much less used to hearing that kind of tone, disrespectful tone, and it was intentionally disrespectful, used toward ultra-Orthodox rabbis or other religious figures.
Now, you worked for the Begin government as the head of the government press office. I mean, Begin was a very conservative prime minister. Were your politics as conservative in the United States as they were considered when you got to Israel, or did your politics, did you have a different, did you, were you positioned differently politically in America than in Israel?
Well, I don't know. I think the political positioning is sometimes oversimplified in the United States. Begin's domestic policies, were he an American president, would have put him to the left of Teddy Kennedy. He favored everything from affirmative action to open immigration to extremely populistic economic policies. Begin was not a conservative. He was a hawk. And he was also very determined to hold on to all of the land of Israel. I never shared that kind of an ideological determination to hold on to all of the land of Israel. I thought that for security reasons we ought to try it until there was a change in the Arab world. But I certainly appreciated Begin's hawkishness. Now, in America, I wasn't a hawk on Vietnam because I didn't think that the war in Vietnam was a sensible war. But I certainly thought, for example, that Begin's destruction of the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981, which was condemned by American liberals as being a terrible act of aggression, was an act of enormous courage and fantastic foresight. And in fact, if it weren't for Begin having done that in 1981, I wouldn't be talking to you, at least not from this world. We'd all be dead. And so since the context was different, I suppose that my political positioning was different. Begin also, and in this he may be different from his successor, Mr. Shamir, was capable, despite his ideology, of considerable flexibility. It was Begin, after all, who agreed to give back the entire Sinai for peace with Egypt. I'm not sure that Mr. Shamir, who was opposed to that, would today, if he were offered a similar deal, agree to it.
In the best-selling book From Beirut to Jerusalem, Tom Friedman of the New York Times spends several pages talking about you, and he describes you like this. If Theodore Herzl and Janis Joplin had a child together, it would have been Zev. How do you like that?
Well, that just proves that Friedman doesn't know anything about rock and roll, which I could have told him even before he wrote the book. I would have taken Etta James as my mother and not Janis Joplin. The Herzl part is all right. Tom is a terrific writer, and he's very good at these sort of clever characterizations, and that one will probably follow me around for the rest of my life.
Do you miss rock and roll in Israel? Is there enough good stuff for you there?
Well, we have had some fun with that. You know, when I got to Israel in 67, we were still in the accordion age. In fact, the first, I remember I got off the plane and the first song that I heard when I got on the bus was "On the Baby's Knuckle or the Baby's Knee, Where Will the Baby's Dimple Be?" And I think that's Doris Day. And I almost got off the bus and went home to Detroit. It was a very frightening experience. But we have progressed since then. We've come a long way. And I've had a, I must say, if there's anything I'm proud of in my 25 years in Israel, it's the very modest role that I've played as a rock and roll pioneer. I was the co-author of the first and I think only Hebrew doo-wop song.
Now you're going to have to sing us a chorus of it.
Never.
Oh,
I didn't say
on.
I was the singer. I was just the songwriter. But because things were so wide open, we've been able to do some things, some experimental things, which have been great fun. And, of course, now Israel is getting hooked up to world cable television like everybody else, and so you can watch MTV. And I suppose that my 9-year-old son, Shmulik, will probably grow up singing the lyrics to the latest American songs just like all the other kids in the world.
Zev Chaffetz, let's get to your new novel. It's called Inherit the Mob, and it's about a Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper reporter whose uncle is a big Jewish mobster, and when the uncle dies, he bequeaths some of his estate, which is his illegitimate businesses, to the nephew, so the nephew inherits the mob. Why were you interested in Jewish gangsters?
Well, I once wrote a book called Members of the Tribe, which was a trip I took through American Jewish life. Exotic characters. And I ran into a guy in Detroit named Maxie Silk, who is now in his 80s and long since gone good, but when he was young, was one of these Damon Runyon-esque Jewish gangsters in Detroit. And Maxie, I was fascinated by his stories and also by the way he talks. He's the last, I think, the last person in the world who speaks Damon Runyon as a first language. And I listened to the rhythms of it, and I listened to the stories about it, and I gradually became interested in that little subculture of Jewish life, which when I was growing up was repressed because nobody, you know, when you got a book for your bar mitzvah, you know, you think that the only Jews who ever lived were Einstein and Freud and a couple of other geniuses and Hank Greenberg. And, you know, we discovered that here were all these guys, you know, Dutch Schultz and Lepke, Buckhalter and Lansky and so forth, that we had never been told about. And so I became interested, and I see that the interest is not just mine. I mean, there's been a proliferation in the last couple of years of books and movies. A friend of mine, Robert Lacey, just has a book out now on Mayor Lansky, and there's I see that they're making a movie of Billy Bathgate, which is about Dutch Schultz. So I think that there's an interest among a growing number of people in this, you know, fascinating and somewhat secretive cult of Jewish gangsters.
You had described when you first got to Israel that part of the excitement for you was the euphoria and also the patriotism. The United States was going through the Vietnam War, and you were so struck by a country whose people felt so strongly about it. Well, Israel always hasn't always stayed in that kind of euphoric state. There are a lot of divisions in Israel. You had to sit in rooms with gas masks on during the Gulf War. With the euphoria gone, and when Israel is very divided, do those strong feelings always stick with you, the strong feelings about the country?
Well, the feelings have changed, obviously. You're right. Israel is not the euphoric place that it was right after the war in 1967. It's become, I think, a much more realistic country. It's become a much more mature country. And I have the great advantage of having been born only 1 year before Israel. So Israel and I are getting middle-aged together. And so I'm probably a less euphoric person and more realistic in what I expect from a place that I live. And those things which I do expect, Israel has delivered. It's given me a country which I respect and a country which I'm fond of. It's given me a good place to raise two children. A constant stream of excitement. I mean, you wake up in the morning and turn on the news in Israel with an expectation that you don't have any place else. You know, one day it's Scuds falling on you, and the next day it's 30,000 Ethiopian Jews being airlifted to Israel, and the day after that it's the flood of Russians coming in, and there's sort of an endless excitement about being an Israeli. And so those things are positive. I've become cranky like everybody else. There are things that annoy me. There are things that, thank God, because I wouldn't have anything to write about otherwise. But on the whole, I've managed to retain a lot of affection for Israel and a lot of respect for it.
Zev Chafetz, his new novel is Inherit the Mob. His book about Detroit, Devil's Night, just came out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and here's some Etta James for Zev Chafetz.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many of us pass homeless people on the street and wonder how they ever got that way. But composer and director Elizabeth Suedos sees homeless people and thinks about her brother Lincoln. He was a paranoid schizophrenic who made his living on the street. Coming up, a talk with Suedos about her brother and the effect his illness had on her family. Her new family memoir is called The Four of Us. Also, book critic John Leonard tells us about two new mysteries, The Song Dog by James McClure and Personal Effects by Marissa Peasman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. The White House says there's no word yet on the fate of American hostage Jesse Turner. Earlier today, the official Iranian news agency said Turner had been freed by his captors in Beirut, and unnamed State Department officials told several news agencies Turner was on his way to Damascus. But later, Syrian officials told reporters waiting for Turner to arrive in Damascus no release was imminent. According to a Federal Reserve Bank study released today, minorities in some parts of the country are 3.5 times more likely to be denied home mortgages than white applicants. Bruce Gellerman of member station WBUR reports the rejection rate for blacks in Boston is the highest in the nation.
This is the first time the Federal Reserve Bank has analyzed mortgage lending by race, gender, and income, and it shows a wide discrepancy in lending practices among banks in the 20 largest metropolitan areas. Blacks living in Washington, D.C., for example, have the best chance of getting mortgages, but still, they're rejected twice as often as whites. In Boston, blacks are 3 times, and Hispanics twice as likely to be denied mortgages compared to whites. Boston Congressman Joseph Kennedy authored the law that required the study be conducted.
The statistics are astounding. I mean, if you're a wealthy black, you're more likely to be turned down than if you're a poor white. There's just no way they can explain this other than the fact of the pattern of discrimination that exists in the industry.
Kennedy says the Federal Reserve is partially to blame for the figures and is calling on the Federal Bank to enforce fair lending laws. For National Public Radio, this is Bruce Gellerman in Boston.
For over 3 decades, the International Atomic Energy Agency has kept a loose rein on the nuclear development programs of third world nations. The IAEA's experience in Iraq, however, has changed that attitude. More from Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says the Security Council could crack down on any country illegally developing nuclear weapons. And, says Hans Blix, the agency could use data collected from spy satellites to detect covert nuclear plans. Speaking to the General Assembly today, Blix said that if a country fails to declare nuclear installations as Iraq did, inspectors must turn to other sources. The atomic energy chief added that tighter controls are needed if another Iraqi situation is to be avoided. And he said the agency could submit information on secret nuclear installations to the Security Council for further action if an offending country refused to allow inspection. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
New technology may cut the cost of automobile airbags from about $600 to $100 apiece. Massachusetts-based Analog Devices, Inc. said today it's developed an inexpensive electronic chip. The chip would replace the extensive wiring currently in airbags. Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today. Advances led declines by a margin of 5-3. This is NPR News. The Bush administration may propose cutting middle-class taxes as one of several measures to boost the economy. White House spokesperson Marlon Fitzwater said today the administration is looking at a number of options, but he gave no details. Fitzwater's hint comes one day after Democratic Senator Lloyd Benson unveiled his 5-year plan to jumpstart the economy. Benson's proposal includes a 5% cut in defense spending, a $300 tax credit for children, and renewing tax deductions for money invested in IRAs. Polls show Americans disapprove of Bush's handling of the economy by a 2-to-1 margin. 15,000 demonstrators spilled into the streets of Zaire's capital, Kinshasa, today, protesting the firing of the country's prime minister. Zaire's president Mobutu fired the prime minister after the two squabbled over who was the ultimate authority in the government. The BBC's Ophibia Quistarkton is monitoring the situation from the Ivory Coast.
President Mobutu has finally sacked Etienne Tshisekedi after weeks of political uncertainty and previous threats to dismiss the opposition prime minister he didn't want in the first place. Zaire's official news agency said that Mr. Mobutu had signed a presidential decree revoking the appointment. This ends the most unlikely political alliance, which many say was doomed to fail. Yesterday, Mr. Mobutu indicated that he was looking for a replacement for Mr. Tshisekedi and called on the opposition coalition to find another candidate. But Mr. Tshisekedi has not given up the battle, despite the fact that his interim government was declared illegal and unconstitutional last week. His transitional government, sworn in only 5 days ago, has not even had the chance to begin to try to resolve the economic, political, and social chaos in Zaire after riots a month ago.
The BBC's Ophibia Quistarkton. Former President Jimmy Carter will lead an international observer team to monitor Zambia's national elections. The elections are Zambia's first in 17 years. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Elizabeth Suedos is a successful avant-garde theater composer and writer. Her new book is a memoir about her family and mental illness. She's from an upper-middle-class family in Buffalo, New York, but her brother, Lincoln Suedos, ended up a schizophrenic street person in Manhattan. Before we talk, here's a reading from her book.
Most middle-class people ask themselves haunting questions about the homeless, the so-called Bowery bums, and crazy people who populate the streets of New York. We all get panhandled. Once in a while, we may be witness to a raspy, nonsensical speech about politics or God. We often walk past ragged creatures who sleep on gratings and whose urine trails into the street. The numbers of these people are growing. The middle-class person asks, how did these people get here? Who are they? Where are their families? How did they fall so low? We all harbor fears about the difference between the mad street people and ourselves. How far are we from losing all our money and our grace and ending up ranting on a corner, holding up a piece of cardboard over a cup? Each person who approaches a passerby on the street has his or her own story. He or she was brought low by a specific personal demon, be it economic, social, or otherwise. When you think this way, the conditions in the street become unbearable. You are in touch with the humanity of each individual and can't block his or her suffering out by blaming a global condition.
Elizabeth Suedos, reading from her family memoir, The Four of Us. Her brother Lincoln made his living on the street playing his harmonica. He died in his shabby storefront apartment in 1989, shortly after he had been told he was being evicted. The building was going to be renovated. Friends tried to set him up in halfway houses, but he wouldn't go. He refused to leave his apartment, even after construction had begun. A shed was erected outside the storefront, blockading the entrance to his place. When Suedos realized he was still inside, she banged on the shed to get him to let her in, but he wouldn't respond. This was one of the many times he wouldn't let her help him. I asked what her frustrations were.
He was 8 years older than me, and I grew up worshiping him. He was my hero. I thought he was the most creative and funny guy that I'd ever met. He wore Madras Bermuda shorts and sunglasses, and he knew Tom Lehrer songs, and he could talk about Andy Warhol, and he sent me telegrams on my graduation about Bobby Kennedy, and he was, you know, he was really hip. He was a bopper, and I didn't know he was sick, really. So gradually, as I got into my late 20s, I began to realize that there was something really quite wrong with him. And he also began to not want to talk to me for reasons that seemed arbitrary, but that I'm sure in his thinking were quite logical, but he really just wanted me out of his life. And I tried to establish contact with him, and we did through the mail, some telephone calls, and a lawyer. So by the time he reached this crisis point, we were in uneven but close contact, and I tried very hard to look for a place for him to move to. But unfortunately, he really rejected. It was the nature of his illness that he would reject a great deal of help from anyone. He'd accept it one day, reject it the next. When I was banging on that shed, I was banging on it knowing that he was falling a long, dark fall towards, if not death, then a very bad psychotic episode. Because if he was cutting himself off from the world, he was not being able to face the reality that he had to change his home. It was a very dark time.
You write in your book that the effects of mental illness became a dominating force in your home because no one could admit it existed. In fact, when your brother was diagnosed as schizophrenic and institutionalized, you weren't told about it. You were told, I think, that he went to college. What effect did it have on you to have that hidden from you?
I think it was probably one of the most negative forces in my psyche, because I had this adored person who one day went to college and never came home again. And what followed were really a series of strange and agitated conversations behind a closed door in my parents' bedroom, and strange phone calls to me late at night from a man who sounded like my brother, but who said he was a teacher from this place or a Vietnam vet or this or that. And over the years, there'd be telegrams or there'd be a cartoon that might come through the mail, but I never knew what happened to him. And finally, I was taken to New York to a private psychiatric hospital to visit him. And even then, he didn't admit it. I was taken in to meet his doctor. His doctor said nothing. Later on, when he became even worse and jumped in front of a subway and lost his arm and his leg, and my parents went to New York to spend a great deal of time with him, I was still told that it was just an accident, that there was nothing, you know, one could do. I went to visit him after that so-called accident, and he was behaving strangely, jumping up and down on like a rabbit on one foot and making sure that I saw what he looked like. And still I was told that he had had an accident, that he was eccentric, that he'd be getting employment soon, that he was writing a novel, that he was going to be maybe in a coffee house singing at the Café Wa. And I watched my mother become increasingly more remote and my father more agitated and angry, and I had not a clue.
You were pretty young. You were a teenager, I think, when your brother tried to kill himself by jumping in front of a train, an accident in which he lost an arm and a leg. Your mother tried to kill herself when you were young and then succeeded in taking her life years later. But you write in your book that when you were young, you had a romantic view of suicide, and that you saw self-destruction as a way of life that belonged to the gifted, the sensitive, and the poetically insane. And I think that that's something that a stage that a lot of young people go through, seeing self-destruction as being a sign of artistic giftedness. How did you outgrow that?
That's an interesting question.
I guess I ask that, you know, because a lot of people go through that stage, and what they know about that kind of what they know about it comes from reading biographies of the writers and artists that they most admire. But you saw it in your own family.
I think I outgrew it over a period of years because I personally experienced devastating effects of my mother's suicide, the feeling of that she had checked out without ever wanting to know what happened to me, that she had left me without caring whether I had children or a career or a life, that my brother walked around maimed and cut me off when he felt like it and drew me in when he felt like it. And I guess I began to see it as something so selfish, because in all of it, I disappeared. And I think that I didn't want to be a disappearing creature. I think I wanted to be a loved person who simply went through hard times with her loved ones and saw them through it, and not have people so involved in their darkness that they decide to leave the world. You see, once, as I began to get older and as I began to experience the loneliness that one feels when left behind, I no longer found what they did to be very romantic.
Composer and writer Elizabeth Suedos is my guest. Her new memoir about her family is called The Four of Us. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Composer and writer Elizabeth Suedos is my guest. When you look back on your brother's life and death, do you think that in his last years he should have been institutionalized, that he would have been better off if he were?
I don't know. You know, it's a question that I think I've asked myself, not just about those years, but about 20 years of his life. I think it's a question that my father also fought with inside himself for many years. I mean, what does it mean to be institutionalized? Where are you sending someone? I don't know if that's the answer to a spirited soul such as my brother was. However, staying on the streets, he got himself into many, many fights. He was in danger. He didn't take care of himself. It's a terribly difficult question, and I think it points up how much thinking and work has to be done so that people who are psychotic are dealt with in a way that can help heal them rather than just keep them in a safe place, because I think that's degrading. So to answer your question, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know.
You know, there's a lot of research now about whether mental illness runs in families. Is there a genetic connection? And having both a mother and brother who suffered from this, do you worry about yourself?
Do I worry about myself? I have to sort of look at my life and say, well, there's a difference. I seem to be able to survive. The darkness that they left inside of me is undeniable. I don't think that I am genetically predisposed to hallucinations or delusions or flights from reality. And I think that I'm very lucky. And I don't really spend a lot of time thinking about that. I think I did when I was a younger woman. I'm a young woman now, but when I was a younger woman, I think I worried a whole lot that I would end up like my mother, depressed and in misery with the world and stuff. And so I kind of kept a record. Well, when she was 19, she was married. When I was 19, I won an OB. when she was 20, she had a baby that was going to ruin her life. When I was 20, I was in Europe. You know, I used to keep this like scoreboard, and it was like, you know, exhausting. I'm past the point now where I need to keep that scoreboard. The maintenance that I have to do, growing up in a family as I've depicted in The Four of Us, is to make my peace with them and find joy in the world and find love in the world without paying tolls to them for their misery. It's called guilt, you know, the survivor guilt. So I deal with that.
So what do you do now each time you pass someone who's homeless? Do you often think about your brother? Do you often think, like so many of us think, well, how do I behave? What do I do?
I have a pretty good idea of how to behave around schizophrenic people when they're in a state of psychosis, which is that since I'm not a trained professional, nor am I in any way equipped to comfort them, I pretty much stay clear. I never see anyone on the street without thinking about my brother. A day never goes by where I don't think about my brother or my mother. I think that will probably be true for the rest of my life, or for my father, for that fact. I mean, just because he's okay, that I think we're all very deeply connected to our families. That's another point of the book, is regardless of what the family might be, they are there inside, and you have to make peace. A person on the street can often make me very angry. I want to say, why are you like that? You know, again, I keep asking the same question. Why do you have to be like that? Why, you know, schizophrenic behavior can make me angry very quickly, regardless of the fact that I know it's involuntary. It's as involuntary as having cancer, but I still can be made very angry by it. And other times I'm very, very sad.
Composer and writer Elizabeth Suedos. Her new family memoir is called The Four of Us. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel, host of All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing about all the conflicting reports out of Lebanon today concerning the releases of hostages. Also, Daniel Schorr on the prospects for the Madrid conference on the Middle East, the news about the Indian earthquake, the elections in Turkey, the violence in South Africa, also Hong Kong's plans to repatriate Vietnamese boat people forcibly, and we'll also be hearing about a new machine that lets music stores stock sheet music more easily. Actually, it's by computer. A Michelin Green Guide to Washington, D.C., and designer Eric Stoller's latest urban UFO. It's called Octos, a circular, functioning bicycle built for eight. Coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Book critic John Leonard has a review of two new mystery novels whose stories are worlds apart. Personal Effects by Marissa Peasman is set in New York City. The action in The Song Dog by James McClure takes place in South Africa.
In his eight previous mysteries, James McClure has been every bit as harsh on South African politics and culture as Nadine Gordimer. He's just written about his society from the bottom up instead of the top down. In the course of their murder investigations, the Afrikaner police lieutenant Trump Kramer and his Bantu detective sergeant Mickey Zondi see South Africa at its worst. The bloody race hatred, the distorted sexuality, the lunatic gleam of the landscape. But between them, they also manage to form a most peculiar partnership, pre-political, platonic in the several senses of that word, and mystical, too. Their sort of brotherhood may be South Africa's only way out of a savage reckoning. And yet the sense in every one of McClure's novels is that it's too late. Monsters rule the realm. Meanwhile, and this is what amazes, Kramer and Zondi laugh. The Song Dog is a splendid prequel to the other mysteries. In 1962, investigating the murder of an Afrikaner policeman with whom he identifies perhaps too much, Kramer will meet Zondi for the first time. He also meets the ocean, all that water, for the first time. "There's one hell of a lot of it," says Kramer. "Ja," agrees his guide. "And remember, as my grandpa always used to say, that is only the top." After they've met, but before they've stumbled onto one of McClure's typically obsessive sexual secrets, Kramer and Zondi will go to a mountaintop to consult a witch who speaks to the Song Dog, a sort of Zulu sphinx. From this sphinx, we hear a chilling prophecy of the fate of Nelson Mandela, who's just been arrested in 1962. If you haven't read McClure before, this will send you to the others. If you have, you don't need me to tell you to buy it immediately. I don't know why Marissa Peaseman's mysteries aren't published in hardcover. In Personal Effects, as in her first novel, Unorthodox Practices, Peaseman is every bit as savvy about manners and morals in modern New York as, say, Tom Wolfe, every bit as satirical, and tells a better story besides. Her amateur detective, Nina Fishman, is a 35-year-old lawyer looking for love and finding an inferiority complex on Manhattan's Upper West Side. When her best friend is murdered after placing one too many ads in the personals column of New York Magazine, Nina dangles herself as bait. We hear about therapy, leather bars and coach bags, utopian socialism, Jewish intellectuals, single malt scotch and yuppie car phones. We go hiking and sit shiva. We also almost get killed. While the mystery in Personal Effects is not exactly dazzling, neurotic Nina is irresistible, as if Molly Dodd from television had shown up in the movie Sea of Love. Listen to her in a high-ticket restaurant waiting for a blind date. She had never figured out why investment bankers seemed to grease their hair back like bikers did. But both the men and the women wore the same elegantly tailored loose-fitting slacks and tieless shirts buttoned up to the neck in textured silk or rayon. The women had fabulous $300 silver pins at the necks of their shirts. Instead of the fabulous pins, the men wore $300 silver belt buckles. There was a lot of reptile skin wrapped around the feet and waists of both sexes. There was probably more reptile skin in this place than in the entire reptile house in the Bronx Zoo. This is nifty, and so is Nina, and so is Marissa Peaseman.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Bill Cosby. Also, creating a culture of fear. We examine how Chile, a country with a long tradition of democracy, became a dictatorship and then returned to democracy. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Give us a call here. The umbrella, I believe, is your...